This podcast is part of the London Business School series, Inside the Global Economy, in which leading experts explore what is really going on in the global economy today.
Welcome to this episode of Inside the Global Economy. I'm Linda Yu, and we are going to look at Europe and concerns over an economic slowdown and potentially whether or not we may even think about a financial crisis somewhere in the world during this part, this downward part of the global business cycle. So on the podcast today are two eminent economics professors from the London Business School, Helene Ray and Lucretia Rushlin. I encourage everyone listening to this podcast to please check out both of their research. Helene's work has changed the nature of how we understand the international financial system and economies. And Lucretia, of course, has revolutionized the way we think about one of the things that we get asked most about, which is where is the economy headed? Her company, Nowcasting, has completely changed the paradigm. So we're just going to kick off. I'm going to ask both of you to just comment on, are we facing a potential recession in Europe or globally? And perhaps even more importantly, is there enough policy making capacity to counteract any such slowdown? Helene.
So on the first part of your question, I think there's no doubt that the global economy has been slowing down, in particular the manufacturing sector, but now also the service sector. Now, it may not be the end of the story because we face very strong uncertainty at this juncture. So there's uncertainty coming both from the White House and the trade war with China. That's a big one, and it's very unpredictable. There's another type of uncertainty which is very unpredictable for Europe, especially, and that is Brexit. And there, I don't think we know a lot. However, we do see already the signs of uncertainty on the UK economy, for sure. We do have now a lot more data about, you know, what firms tell us about what uncertainty does to their investment plan, their thinking. And we see a significant slowdown in investment in the UK, which is also showing up in productivity numbers. We also see that FDI flows have been affected by the Brexit shock. We see that actually there has been some FDI outflows out of the UK into the EU, but the reverse, this is not true, actually. We see that EU inflows have not, if anything, they have gone down to the UK. So there is a lot going on. The euro area is also in a slowing down state, and that may be tipped over even more by these two threats that I just discussed. And there, to go to the second part of your question, I think, unfortunately, what we see in the euro area right now is a very unbalanced macro policy mix, with monetary policy, which has already done a lot. And it's a little bit hard to see how much more monetary policy can do without the help of fiscal policy. And unfortunately, in the euro area, we are in a situation in which the countries which have fiscal space, for example, the big one being Germany, does not seem to be ready to actually do something, while a lot of other countries are pretty constrained on the fiscal side. So as a result, we seem to be in a situation with a wrong policy mix. We have possibly too loose monetary policy with too tight monetary policy as an equilibrium outcome. And if we have too tight monetary policy, the ECB, who is concerned about the welfare of the whole euro area, has no, you know, other thing to do that, you know, to fulfill its mandate, but to be looser. And things would be a lot better if we could change this policy mix. But fiscal policies are national at the euro area, and they don't internalize the welfare of the whole area. So we're in a little bit in trouble looking forward.
Lucretia, your take on this?
Well, I would agree with Helene about a lot of the things she said. We are definitely are in a slowdown in the euro area, in Europe in general, and in the world. The IMF has revised downward the predictions for growth. On the euro area, actually the slowdown has started already in late 2017, so it has been going on for a while. And I would say to add, complement a bit what Hélène said, that there are two issues. One is whether this persistent slowdown will end up in actually a recession, so negative growth, two consecutive quarter negative growth as the recession is normally defined, or is instead signaling very persistent change which has to do with actually potential output and the cumulative effect of a very bad two crises, so legacy, combined with very timid policy, I would say mostly fiscal, but also pro-growth policies and the wrong policy mix. So is it temporary? Is it permanent? Are we Japan in other ways? Are we facing a kind of a Japanification of the economy in which we will grow at a low rate but without any major crash? Or are we facing a recession? So this is one point, one big question. The other question is whether this slowdown has to do with some kind of idiosyncratic issues like, you know, the effect of the trade war on manufacturing. The question there is whether it's going to be idiosyncratic or it's going to be temporary or it's something we have to learn to live with. And I would say that most people think that unless something serious changes in the U.S., this kind of uncertainty is there to stay. But the effect, for example, in the manufacturing sector, in the automobile sectors, especially in Germany, how serious is the German slowdown? Germany is the big country in Europe, is the locomotive of Europe, and the car industry is very important. A lot of Germans say, well, this low growth that we have experienced recently is just temporary. It has to do with some very specific issues facing the automobile industries. But then if you really think a little bit more about it, I would say it's more serious because the uncertainty related to trade worldwide, but also Brexit, it will be more persistent. And also technological change. And technological change in the car industry will have very deep consequences, and the Germans are probably lagging behind. So, you know, this will have big implications about the growth of the whole area, so not only Germany. Policy mix. So, in principle, monetary policy can do more, okay, so that there is a lot that monetary policy can do. Draghi has recently been criticized because of the aggressiveness of the last package of measures to sustain the cycle. But you could argue actually that they should have moved earlier because, you know, actually the slowdown was visible already from in late 17. They could do more, but of course I think they have reached a political limit in which, you know, this new type of policies from negative rates to more QEs start having large redistributive consequences in different parts of the union. And therefore, this has made a lot of people unhappy. This is normal, but I think that given the complicated nature of our union, it will be very difficult to govern the political process. So this is why the ECB says, and everybody says, we should do more fiscal. But is that actually credible? I am not so sure, because I don't think that a macroeconomic framework based on the idea that you go to Germany to say you have to expand fiscal policies because this is good for the euro area is going to work, because, you know, these things don't work with sovereign states, and we don't have a sufficiently robust coordination process. So if we had to have a big crisis, I am sure that the finance ministers ahead of governments would sit together and maybe produce an aggressive anti-cyclical package. I think that maybe now there is the political experience and with coordination to work together in emergency. But I really don't think that they would put together a decent package just to have a kind of anti-cyclical policy in normal times. So I think that monetary policy will remain the big game in town. And so the whole issue will be how to govern this process with a new president of the ECB, who will also have to review the strategy of the institution, which has a lot of ambiguous part and things that will have to be revised. And I'm sure that this is not going to be an easy job. But as economists, we'll have to, you know, make sure that these things is done in a proper way and corresponding to what we know about the fact of monetary policy and best practice in central banking.
So you mentioned there the potential of a crisis, perhaps for some coordination, and that's when you might find some type of fiscal policy along the lines of what Helene was describing, which is politically difficult at the moment. And of course, Christine Lagarde taking over as the president of the ECB comes from the International Monetary Fund, which has dealt a lot with financial crises and rescues. So I don't want to jinx anything, but I'm going to ask you to, is there a risk that with this slowdown, we could see a financial crisis, whether it's in Europe or elsewhere? Helene?
So first of all, it's true that Christine Lagarde has the right set of skills, just in case we would have a crisis, which nobody wishes for. But just before I answer that, on the need for this fiscal push, so it is true that at the euro area level, we do not have fiscal capacity that could be used to coordinate things and to push through investment at the euro area level. At the country level, so we have these political constraints that we discussed. But there is a dimension that I think is going to be coming more and more into play, which is that all the countries are gradually committing to decarbonize their economy. There is climate change. And in order to do that, it's not costless. But if countries are serious, they will have to make big investments. They will have to. And they have to do that, you know, the earlier the better, because the costs are rising over time. And we are currently in an environment in which real rates are negative, very low, very low. So there is no better time to actually start to invest. So now, as we start to think about, you know, what is the likelihood that finally some countries would use a little bit more fiscal policy, I would think, depending on the political dynamics, but in particular if the green parties are rising on the continent, there could be a serious opportunity there. And the second thing I would like to say is that very often countries tend to, you know, to claim that it's not prudent to increase debt or to expand government spending or to do some investment. That's very much an argument we hear in some quarters. But I would very much question that. I mean, precisely in this environment of climate change, not investing is actually not prudent because the costs are rising over time and climate debt is rising. So I think we have to really change our thinking about these issues. And that's something that everybody will have to be very serious about in the next, you know, not in 20 years. It's coming very fast. So in the next 5 years. If climate change comes even quicker than we think, with a lot of consequences, maybe again migrations, maybe a lot of assets which become impaired, that in itself can be destabilizing. And I'm not sure we manage that risk very well so far. So that could be another factor of crisis on top of the usual risk factors, which we discussed before, so the trade war, uncertainty, and also, you know, the high level of debt. And if we talk about the euro area, there's still the issues of high level of debt in some countries, together with weak banking system in similar countries, which create, again, this kind of adverse feedback between the financial system and the sovereign debt, which can be highly destabilizing. We have seen it in the past, in the periphery of a euro area. This bad mechanism can go back into play if, again, risk goes up and risk premia goes up. We can see, again, some destabilizing feature there. And another type of destabilizing mechanism that we know a little bit less about, but it also can come from the financial sector, is the fact that following the Basel III regulations and the big financial crisis, so we have tightened regulation on banks, we do have more capital, but as a result, there's quite a bit of banking activity or pseudo-banking activities which have migrated in the so-called non-banking sector or shadow banks, depending how you want to call it. And there, I think we're a little bit less aware about the interconnections, about the liquidity risks and how the propagation mechanism would work. So that's another risk factor that I think should be on the radar screen.
Lucretia, your take on this, the risk of a crisis or a financial crisis, and then again, will there be the potential for policy to counteract it, say, internationally?
I think actually the topic of climate change is very important because we could think of local crises, more local crises coming up. Related to climate because of risk that we are not measuring and we are not taking into account. And, we can think of all kind of spillovers, given the fact that also our insurance system is not designed to deal properly with this kind of risk. I mean, it is, but, given the acceleration of the accidents that we can envisage, from local crises, this could actually propagate to much more pervasive. So the spillovers could probably be stronger than what we think about. So I think that if somebody asks me, do you think there will be a big financial crisis in Europe tomorrow? I don't think so, because banks are more capitalized and we have, much more preventive tools, but also I think we are much more ready, perhaps, that in 2008. To face a new big event. On the other hand, crisis will come again. We know that this happens. And I'm sure that this time will come from different aspects of the economy. And I think that the interaction between climate and the fact that the financial system and our insurance systems and our, accounting systems, our risk management is not ready for that kind of shocks could be a new factor. And I think it's really very important that the regulators, the accounting standards institutions, the risk management, the banks and so on start thinking seriously about how to measure risk in this consideration. Considering that if we have a climate big shock, there is no land of last resort for this kind of events. So it's much worse than a financial crisis. So it's not enough to have a central bank producing and printing money. It's something much more fundamental. So this is a fundamental risk in our society. And I am persuaded that the risk aversion that we see around, which also explains why there is very little investment, even if interest rates are negative, is partly due to the uncertainty of things like climate change that we really do not know how they will factor in our economic life. So this is part of the story of why uncertainty is so pervasive and so why there is so much risk aversion around. What to do about it? I have a lot of sympathy for what Hélène said about fiscal policy related to climate. We can think also monetary policy related to climate. There is an active discussion in central banking about doing asset purchases related to clean energy and so on. And I am sure that Christine Lagarde will push in that direction. She has already made some speeches in that direction, and I really welcome that. On the other hand, this will be more in the direction of investment and, there will be some kind of delay on the effect of these kind of programs in the economy. Is quite different than, say, we have a fiscal tool for anti-cyclical policy, which is how we think about fiscal policy in relation to monetary policy. Of course, it will help. Of course, we have to push for that. And very seriously, we have to push that this would happen and that there will be enough money on the table. Because everybody now is talking about it. But then, of course, the question is that if you want to have a big investment programs related to climate in Europe, there is the issue how you're going to finance it. Will it be debt financing? Or there will be a European tax, or each country will go alone. And then what will happen with the countries that don't have fiscal capacities? And, we are back in that kind of discussion. So hopefully there will be a European view on this because it's quite strategic. And I think a lot of different constituencies in Europe are now quite persuaded that we should go in that direction.
Hmm. And before I move on to a longer term view of Europe's growth prospects, just on this point of should we have a global shock of some sort, is there the capacity for policymakers, say, to coordinate Is there enough cooperation between major economies if the global financial system were somehow at risk? If it could be any number of shocks that you've described, and Lucretia, I think you've spoken about it before in terms of central banks being willing to, say, coordinate opening up the cash flows between them if there was another global financial crisis.
Well, I think that in 2008, there was an amazing ability, okay, to actually for different countries to coordinate, in particular central banks, with the swap lines, okay, so that the loans, special loans that the Federal Reserve gave to other central banks, which made it possible to avoid a meltdown, given the central role of the dollars in the financial system. The role of the Federal Reserve is very important in that respect. Now, will that happen today? Again, I think that with Jeremy Powell, yes, with this Fed. But, you know, we should not be complacent because we are witnessing an incredible attack to the independence of the Federal Reserve. I think this is happening especially in the U.S., but we will see more of it in the future for different reasons, also because central banks have acquired such a central role in the policy mix all over the world. And with this kind of administration in the U.S., nothing is guaranteed. So we could be in a situation in which actually the Federal Reserve would say, sorry, we're not cooperating, and there would be more negotiations, more, kind of conditionality and so on. And this is something for sure is a matter of concern.
Mm. Helen?
Yeah, may I add on this? So I agree with Lucrezia. So in 2008, so we had these massive swap lines from the Fed up to, $600 billion even, or $700 billion at the peak, from the U.S. in particular to the European banking sector. And that reflected a very long-standing cooperation also across central bank. I mean, it was not the first time. It's something that, was orchestrated earlier. Also in the 60s, we had swap lines, etc. So the central bankers are very much used to international cooperation. And in an environment in which it's the dollar, which is the currency at the center of the international monetary system, obviously the lender of last resort has to be the Fed. And this is key, and this is how the system has remained stable. Now, there are reasons to worry looking forward. And so one of the reasons is that recently, Trump seems to be thinking of weaponizing the dollar in some sense, in many different ways. So we see it with the Iranian sanctions and trying to hit people using extraterritoriality of the dollar, essentially, to impose a foreign policy of the United States. But also because Congress is obviously not very internationally minded in terms of cooperation these days. And so these swaps lines were maybe not very much looked at in the past, but there's no guarantee that Congress won't look at them a little bit more closely in the future. And indeed try to, think about conditionalities or stuff like that, which would defeat the purpose of an international lender of last resort. So I think there are serious reasons to worry. Also, one has to remember that these swap lines were not given to everybody. They were given to a subset of the central banks, mostly the G7 central banks. And so if liquidity is needed in other parts of the world, the process is not nearly as smooth. And also remember that we have the rise of another big power, which is China. And so the relations also in the international monetary system can be a lot more conflicted looking forward. So I hope things will go smoothly if we need international liquidity, but I don't think we can be complacent at all. And the last point very quickly that I would like to make is that the IMF plays a central role also for financial stability, but the size of the IMF relatively to the size of international capital flows has gone down, obviously, because flows have gone up a lot and the IMF has not gone up in size that much. And it's very unclear whether the IMF will be able to grow and have enough liquidity in order to face crisis in big countries in the future, because again, we would need the US Congress above all to agree to that. Seems to be a difficult process.
Yes, indeed. But let's take a slightly longer term view in terms of growth prospects in Europe. And Lucretia, you mentioned earlier on that there is a chance that maybe the stagnation we've seen in Japan is something that Europe does need to look at. It is a potential source of concern. So it'd be great to get your take on how you see growth in Europe, the Eurozone, in the coming years, and maybe just the key reform that you would like to see to really make sure that it doesn't become like Japan?
Well, first of all, I must say that I like to forecast the present and the past rather than the distant future.
Well, because now casting what you've done is superb.
Any econometrician will tell you that there is a huge amount of uncertainty, you know, the further you go in the horizon. But yes, I think that I am not particularly optimistic about potential growth in Europe for many reasons. Well, one is demographic. And, you know, we are just behind Japan, but not very much behind. And this is true for Germany, it's true for Italy, maybe not so true for France, but we have very bad numbers in terms of demographic. What can be done? Okay, structural reform, yes. But I think, actually, I am now convinced that we need more public investment. And that this, in my view, will be the big discussion for the next few decades. But if you really think that you really need to have public money to face climate change, we are talking about a lot of money. And we are talking about a lot of public investment. And we are talking about a big interference of the public sector in the economy and a quite a different mix between private market and the public sector, something quite different that we think has been the consensus so far. I think that maybe we have to go there. This is what maybe will do the trick, or at least put us on a much more sustainable rate of growth. Consider also that with low rate of growth, the distributional conflict also become much more bitter. I mean, there is fascinating evidence in economics about how important it is for humans to think that there will be growth so that their children will be better off than the present generation, because that gives a sense of optimism and also tolerance by the fact that there are inequalities. And when there is no growth, tolerance for inequality, it's kind of declines. Whatever you think about whether we want less or more inequality, but our society becomes more dysfunctional. So I think that we need to rethink a lot of fundamental issues about, you know, the relation between the public sector and the market.
Mm. Helene, same question to you about potential growth in Europe.
So as Lucrecia mentioned, there are lots of headwinds. However, I believe there's a lot also of potential in Europe. And this is partly because indeed we are in a society, if we compare it to you know, the United States, or if we compare it to Asia, that has some values which have proved to be, I think, very resilient for the long run. So if we think about the way the welfare system works in Europe, the way we look at data, contrast GDPR with nothing in the US, essentially, or with a Big Brother approach in China. I believe that in the long run, societies which are a little bit less unequal, with a little bit of better regulation, actually are more resilient, provided they make the right policy choices. So I would be quite optimistic about Europe in that type of world, you know, where we see that in the end, if you grow fast, but it benefits the 0.1% of the top of distribution and you get a populist president, you might make very big mistakes, right? So to some extent, Europe might be more robust to that, but robustness doesn't do everything. Europe also should make the right policy decisions. And some of the policy decisions that have to be done have to do first with reinforcing the Eurozone. Okay, there's an incomplete architecture for the Euro area, and it has to be fixed because otherwise we are very vulnerable. Second, we have to make these big investments. And in order to unleash a lot of investment, I think what we should do is relatively simple. We should have a carbon price. And we should have a very predictable path for the carbon price for the future. That would generate synergy between public investment. Obviously, we have to invest a lot, really a lot, in R&D and in research, fundamental research, etc., which would be good for everything. I mean, as most economic papers have found in that domain. But if we had a very predictable path for the carbon price, and that path was obviously upward sloping at the appropriate rate, then private investment also would be unleashed. And I think that's what we have to do. So I would try to be a bit optimistic, but provided, you know, the new team in charge at the Commission and the European Parliament and the new team at the ECB as well. Everybody should kind of look forward.
What a fantastic discussion. Such a privilege to get both of your insights. Thank you both for doing this podcast for the LBS Inside the Global Economy. I'm Linda Yu, and thank you all for listening.
This was a London Business School podcast, bringing you fresh insights and ideas from London Business School's experts. To listen and read more, visit www.london.edu.